Your light just went on, and I wanted to ask that it be put on. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Thank you. The state is asking that this court reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals in this case, which held that the circuit court had erroneously found that the state would be prejudiced if the defendant were allowed to withdraw her no contest pleas before she was sentenced.
What did it hold? Say that sentence again, would you please?
Sure. We are asking that this court reverse the Court of Appeals decision in this case, which held that the circuit court erroneously found that the state would be prejudiced if the defendant withdrew her no contest pleas before sentencing. The Court of Appeals decision was an error because the decision to allow pre-sentence plea withdrawal, including the determination of whether the state would be prejudiced, is a matter for the trial court's exercise of its discretion. Here, the court's finding that the state would be prejudiced was based on the facts of record and was consistent with the controlling legal principles for determining prejudice. It was thus a proper exercise of discretion that the Court of Appeals should have affirmed. The trial court found prejudice in this case for three related reasons. The first and the primary reason that the court found prejudice was that the state would be unable to introduce recorded interviews of the victims about the crimes because she had turned 16 years old during the pendency of the case. The trial court had admitted these interviews pursuant to Section 908.08 of the statutes, which is a hearsay exception that is intended to allow a party to introduce statements of children witnesses in lieu of their direct testimony in order to minimize the mental or emotional strain of testifying would have on that witness. There are a number of considerations the court has to consider before it admits the interviews, but the one that's most relevant here is that the trial is required to begin before the witness turns 16 years old.
And then what happens?
And then they're no longer admissible pursuant to that statute.
Under that statute?
Under that statute, yes, correct.
They could be admissible under other statutes, correct?
They may be, yes.
In fact, that's what the trial court concluded here, that it would be admissible under 908.01 prior consistent statements. But the Court of Appeals said, we take issue with that because it's premature. We don't know if there's going to be any assertion of recent fabrication. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
Improper motive. Okay. What other rules of evidence is it possibly could come under when you retry this, or if you try this case?
I think, as the dissent in the Court of Appeals pointed out, they could come in as, possibly as a recorded recollection. And I'm aware of a case from the Court of Appeals, State versus Snyder, that said the trial court could admit these recordings, similar recordings, pursuant to the residual hearsay exception. But I think the difference between the admission, certainly as prior consistent statements and as a recorded recollection, is that under 908.08, the recordings in this case substitute for the victim's direct testimony.
Oh, but the state clearly intended to call the child witness. The state said that several times, that it intended to call the child witness in conjunction with the video and not in lieu of her testimony.
That's correct. But the recordings would substitute for the bulk of her testimony, and I don't want to speak to what the prosecutor intended to have her testify about. It may just have been very well to lay a foundation for the recordings and then to play the recordings in lieu of her direct testimony. That is what the statute contemplates. And that is why I believe the state intended to get these recordings admitted.
And then under the statute, that's subject to redirect. So anything that's not brought out on direct can be, depending on the appropriate situation. How about using it to refresh your recollection under 906.12? How about that?
Well, she would have to testify and say she could not remember whatever the pertinent fact they were discussing was. And then the state, I think, could show her the recordings and then ask if that refreshes her recollection.
I'm sorry, you were at the first reason. You said the state would be unable to introduce the videos under 90808, but obviously there's a possibility under other statutes.
Yes, but I think that, as I said, the admission under those statutes would be more limited and would constrain the state's case in a way that admission under 90808 would not.
What was the time period between the acts and the original trial and then any item trial plea?
I'm sorry, the time period between the acts and the original trial?
Not a trial, but a plea. And was it the mother's trial? It was a mother and father.
Yeah,
right?
The mother is the defendant in this case.
Okay, the father.
Yeah.
And a new trial.
The acts in this case started in April of 2008,
okay.
And they ended in September of 2008.
Okay.
The interviews with the victim were in October of 2008, about 2 weeks after the abuse was discovered.
Okay.
The original trial, I believe, was scheduled for December of 2009. And the father's trial was after that. I'm not sure of the exact dates, but it was sometime between then and when the defendant moved to withdraw her pleas, which I believe was in March of 2010, and then the actual ruling on her plea withdrawal motion was in May 2010.
Mr. O'Neill, when was the video?
When was the ruling made?
May 2010.
Okay.
When was the video itself made?
There were actually three videos. Two of them were in October of 2008, and then there was one, I believe, made in July of 2009.
And how old was the alleged victim at the time?
She was in October of 2008. She would have been 14. Years old, and in July of 2009, she would have been 15 years old.
Petitioner's Appendix 233. I'm looking at the state's, rather the court's reasonings. That's what you're going through now. And on line 3 of the Appendix 233, the court says, if the state was not allowed to use the safe harbor tapes, it would result in substantial prejudice to the state. This is what I pulled up, but it seemed to me a little broader holding of the judge here. That is, if the state was not allowed to use the safe harbor tapes, it would result in substantial prejudice to the state. But he, at least here, didn't say if the state would be unable to reduce it under 908.08. So can you help me with that? Because we've just gone through a number of statutory provisions where it's certainly possible to get them in under other reasons. Was the circuit court's ruling broad, as it says here, or is it more narrow?
I don't think that the court's use of if and suggesting that I don't think it's a contemplation of the recordings being admissible under a different statutory section.
Yeah, it sounds to me like the way I read it, but correct me, please, if you disagree with that. The way that I read it was that the court was saying that he didn't think that they would be allowed to come in, period. The state wouldn't have use of them, wouldn't have availability of them, and therefore there's substantial prejudice.
I think that read in the context of the entire decision where the state is alleging that the prejudice was under 90808, and it wasn't any contemplation of other statutory provisions.
Oh. Counsel, though, you are mindful, I'm sure, that there is an issue as to what the basis of Judge Schwartz's ruling was on admissibility.
There is, yes.
The motion that was filed by the state was clearly a 908.08 motion. And he started out talking about that and went through some of the factors. But when you look at the conclusion and, the punchline, he says, I'm paraphrasing, but I conclude that the tapes are admissible, and they are admissible under 90801, prior consistent statement. And he cited the Anzani case, which is a prior consistent statement case. And then, kind of interestingly, he went on to say, and of course the victim would have to testify first. And that's contrary to 90808, where the victim testifies after the video is played, according to the words of the statute.
Yes.
So there certainly is argument as to what the basis of that ruling is, I think.
I acknowledge that Judge Schwartz made that ruling, and I think as both the majority and the dissent in the Court of Appeals realized it was premature, it's impossible, not impossible, but very difficult to say something's a prior consistent statement before the victim's, before witness's testimony is attacked under the statute.
In fact, both the majority and the dissent read his ruling as being a ruling based on prior consistent statement rather than 90808.
I would disagree with that. I think both the majority and dissent realized that they recognized that the court decision was also under 90808.
Okay.
The court, Judge Schwartz, spent most of the decision going through the various factors for admission listed under 90808. And I think if you look at the decision as a whole, he is admitting statements pursuant to that statute and alternatively as prior consistent statements.
Okay, the Court of Appeals opinion is
were the tapes used in the trial against Porfirio Bolivar?
Yes, they were.
Okay, how long were the tapes?
I think the court said at the motion to withdraw the plea, if I remember correctly, I could look it up. It said about 3.5 hours total.
So there are 3.5 hours of tape, a lot of which were made certainly within a month of how this all came to light. And isn't there a description about how meaningful the depiction of the victim was in terms of her injuries, in terms of her response to questions, in terms of her truthfulness in answering questions, the absence of any reason to lie. How could that be replicated more than 2 years later? And now, potentially 5 years later.
I think that's correct. I think it would be very difficult for the state to reproduce that. I mean, it may be that this victim would be able to testify completely in the same manner that she appeared in the case, but, I mean, she's not going to obviously physically look the same, but I think, yes, her demeanor after being rescued from this abuse, I assume, has substantially changed since that time. Whether she'd be able to give the same level of detail is a question I think that we could be reasonably debated, but I think the trial court certainly was within its ability to find that it would be very unlikely that she would be able to give that same level of detail.
Wasn't there some mention made in the record in regard to part of the counseling or treatment that the young lady has been going through is to help her, I think the phrase was, put some of these things behind her, help her forget them. So these are things that she's been specifically assisted or advised to do by the mental health professionals who are trying to help her.
The fact, depending on how the court rules, the trial, if there were a new trial,
mm-hmm.
Would now be, five years or something?
Yes.
Is this court entitled to consider the full 5 years, or is that just an illegitimate consideration?
I think when this, as much as I would like this court to consider the full 5 years, I think that if we're reviewing a discretionary decision of the trial court, it's best to review the decision at the time it was made with the facts known to the court at that time.
Okay. Well, what about, isn't there a constitutional amendment and aren't there statutes that direct courts to consider the interests of victims and witnesses in their deliberations?
Yes. Chapter 9.
Does that come into play here?
It may. But ultimately what this court is reviewing is a discretionary decision of the circuit court, which took into consideration the victim's rights under the constitutional amendment in Chapter 950 in finding that she would be harmed if she had to appear for trial after she had been led to believe that she no longer had to testify against her mother.
Let me just ask point blank. Was there a fair and just reason for withdrawing the plea so long after the plea was issued and under circumstances where the defendant knew what the pre-sentence investigation was, knew what happened in the other trial? Why was this a fair and just reason?
Are you asking me or are you asking? I don't think it was a fair and just reason, but the state is not challenging the trial court's determination of
that.
Well,
can this court look at that?
This court, of course, may look at it. I've, by not challenging it, forfeited any argument to it, but I think this court can reexamine. But it is a discretionary decision of the trial court, and the court's decision was based, I think, on the defendant's testimony at the post-conviction hearing. And reviewing it, I think the court was within its rights to accept the defendant's testimony and find that she had a fair and just reason for withdrawing her pleas. I disagree with that decision, but I don't think it's something that could make an argument to challenge.
But you didn't?
I didn't, no.
Okay, so the posture of this case is the trial court found the defendant made a fair and just, had a fair and just statement for the plea withdrawal. That's the first step.
Right.
Then, and you're not challenging that, it's a discretionary, maybe if you were the judge you would have ruled otherwise, but you think it's within his discretion, okay. Then the burden shifts to the state. And the burden shifts to the state, if I understand this, right, and that's bowling, is it? The burden shifts to the state to prove prejudice to the state, right?
Correct.
Substantial prejudice.
Substantial prejudice. Not any old prejudice, as Justice Bradley reminds me, but substantial prejudice. And the issue before this court is, trial court said no substantial prejudice. Substantial prejudice, therefore, no withdrawal. Goes to the Court of Appeals, the Court of Appeals says, no, disagree. Erroneous exercise of discretion is substantial prejudice, right? Do they make that finding, or what do they do?
I don't think they say erroneous exercise of discretion. I think there's a way to interpret their decision as finding an erroneous exercise of discretion, but I don't see a clear statement or explanation what about the trial court's decision was contrary to law or based on an unreasonable finding of the facts. I think their opinion that the legislative policy in 90808 to prohibit the admission of recordings of witnesses once they've turned 16 years old is a conclusion, could be read as a conclusion that the trial court erred as a matter of law or misapplied the law. And I think they also criticized the court's finding of the victim's faded memory of the crimes as lacking any evidence. And so I think they could interpret their decision as saying, well, that's an erroneous finding of fact. But I don't see a clear statement of saying that this is...
Here's what they said. One thing they said. This is on page 106 of your brief.
You say 106?
106 of the appendix. They go through saying that they're not persuaded about whether she's going to testify, whether she can remember, whether they don't know that they're not opining on the admissibility of the recorded statements at a future trial. And then here's the hope. We further, rather, I'm sorry, we must reverse because the state, and the state had the burden of proof, right?
Yes.
Presents no persuasive argument as to why the circuit court correctly concluded that the state was substantially prejudiced by plea withdrawal. You didn't meet the burden of proof at this trial court, they say.
Correct.
Right?
Yes.
Okay.
Counsel, how old did you say the young lady is now?
She was born in, I believe, June of 1994, so she would be 19.
The conduct which was charged in the criminal complaint occurred in between, they say, mainly April of 2008, September of 2008, a time period during which she was 14. Here we sit in 2013, 5 years later, and I read with some little bit of surprise the Court of Appeals uncited, the majority anyway, their uncited assertion that in the absence of some sort of evidence of faded memory, we conclude that it was not reasonable for the circuit court or the dissent to assume that a child of that age would forget to the extent that the state would be prejudiced. Now, there's no cite for that, and I can't help but think to myself, some weeks my calendar is so busy, if you ask me where I was last Tuesday, I'm going to have to ask you for a few minutes so I can go check to find out.
I think that's correct. I think that the fact that, looking at the timeline in this case, it would have been, I think it's reasonable to assume that it would have been 2 years since the charges were filed, and certainly more than 2 years after the abuse against the victim had started before a trial could be held. And that amount of time is reasonable for the trial court to conclude that the victim's memory had faded. I think it has nothing to do with whether
we're 5 years and counting, right?
That's correct.
And in 5 years, it's more than reasonable to think that some of the details have faded. Isn't that right?
Sure, absolutely.
And isn't that right, then, why 908.035 recorded recollection would allow you to get that recording in? A record concerning a matter about which a witness once had knowledge but now has insufficient recollection to enable her to testify fully and accurately, shown to have been made when the matter was fresh in the memory, and to reflect that knowledge correctly is admissible. So why wouldn't it be admissible if this case were retried now? Can you imagine it wouldn't be?
It may be if the victim were to get up and testify that she was unable to remember, but the prejudice to the state in this case is that it cannot use the recordings in the manner allowed by 908.08, which is to use them in lieu of the victim's direct testimony. Admitting if they were admissible to another pursuant to another hearsay exception, it's certain that the defendant would, or excuse me, the victim would have to get up and testify and express her inability to remember or have her credibility attacked by the defendant.
Let's try it, okay? The counsel asks a question of a specific thing. Her response is, I don't remember exactly, or I don't remember fully. And then you have the recording, and it's marked, and you say, was this done at a time when you did remember? Yes, it was. And was it, does it accurately and correctly reflect what happened? Yes, it did. And can you remember all those details now? No, I can't. And, Your Honor, I move for the admission of the exhibit, and it's played.
I think that the state would
– You think the entirety of the tape would be admitted under that hypothetical?
No, I think the state would have to show it piecemeal to show what she would be able to remember, what specific events she wouldn't be able to remember. And it would not be as effective a presentation as just simply showing these recordings in lieu of her direct testimony.
Isn't the difference between refreshing recollection and a past recorded
past recording being admitted. I mean, if someone testifies that they cannot remember anything, then the past recording can come in. Okay. But if they testify and there's bits and pieces that they need their recollection refreshed, then they can look at the document or they can review the other thing, and that the other document doesn't become the piece of evidence. The testimony that's been refreshed becomes the evidence. So those are two different animals that you're talking about. The person would have to testify. They have no recollection of this event, which in and of itself would prejudice the state, would it not? If a victim has no recollection of this kind of an event, that in and of itself. So
I guess the statute says enable her to testify fully.
Yes.
We'll have to see what case law means. I'm not sure that it means no recollection.
I'd like to just raise a question. You can answer it on rebuttal, and I will ask Ms. Fitzgerald to deal with it. You rely on Bolding and State v. Rushing. Both of them noted that the circuit court can determine that a child's faded memory could constitute substantial prejudice. I agree with that. But it was quite clear in Bolding that on review, an appellate court must, quote, ensure that the circuit court's determination was made on facts of record. And in Rushing, the state provided an affidavit that attested to the child's lost memory and the potential harm of additional testimony. Pages 9-11. In Bolig, the state provided no such affidavit, but the child was much younger, 6 years, and that is something that perhaps any court could take judicial notice that a child of 6's recollection and memory is quite limited on this. And of course, everyone loses details on facts over time, but the concept, I mean, she was severely, the allegation, severely abused, right? Broken limbs, etc. I might not remember very much about some trip I took, but I sure remember if I fell and broke a wrist. So the problem here is what in this record supports the state's concept that this witness was not going to be able to remember sufficiently. And that's my question in Fitzgerald, because you have to take the other position, even though the burden of proof is on the state. Patricia A. Fitzgerald, representing the defendant appellant Minerva Lopez. Ms. Fitzgerald.
Please, the court. Good afternoon. Clearly, the court has read the record, or much of the record. I want to make some things clear, though, that various judges have asked, or justices have asked. First of all, there was absolutely no evidence in the record that AO's therapist had required her to, or said that she had to forget what had happened to her.
That was the judge's finding?
That was the judge's finding, and who knows where he got that, because that's not in the record. The state presented absolutely no evidence at that hearing about prejudice. It didn't present. AO had testified at her dad's trial, and that had happened in December. As the state points out in its brief and as it just argued, the tapes were shown at that hearing. But she also, there's an article in the paper that the state cites that she also testified at that hearing. Now, the PSI, AO said she thought she did a good job at testifying at that hearing. And there was absolutely no evidence that the state didn't present any evidence that she had any difficulties at all.
Counselor, isn't it true, though, that one of the things the trial court considered was the impact on the victim with having to testify again? And the things that occurred are so horrific. It's not just a broken arm or a broken leg, as you're well aware. So horrific and so
humiliating as well as painful to this child that to have to put her through that publicly, isn't that something the circuit court was concerned about?
Well, the circuit court certainly didn't say that. I don't doubt that that was perhaps something he had in mind. But you still have to do it based on the record. If this court is going to say
The record, counsel, I won't read you because it'd be too embarrassing to read in open court. But you're familiar with the record and what happened to her.
Well, I am familiar.
And she would have to testify to all the different humiliations and the inflictions of injury that occurred to her one by one. I can't see that wouldn't have been something that the court would consider in regard to the effect on the victim.
Well, I think, if you look at what Judge Schwartz said about the tapes, that he said despite the allegations, she was physically and mentally healthy enough to testify. He also said that she could verbalize about the events, that she didn't show any, he did not make a finding that she showed any kind of fear or guilt or stress. I think the case would be true of many people. It would be difficult to testify. But, we do have people come in and testify in person. Now, if it would have been a problem for her to testify, the state could have brought in her therapist. They didn't. There was absolutely no testimony brought in. Further, there was nothing shown that either that she has forgotten anything, and there was nothing shown that she would be in jeopardy emotionally if she had to testify. In fact,
put in an affidavit that she didn't want to go through this. Did she put in an affidavit?
No.
But there was something in the PSI, as I recall, that the foster parent said that she had some, I'm paraphrasing it, it was difficult for her to testify at her father's trial. Wasn't there a phrase in the PSI that was attributed to the foster parent?
Well, actually, what she said, what AO said, was that she thought she did a good job testifying at her dad's trial. And there was also a statement saying that she was tired of going to court by this
yes,
time.
And the foster parent, I think it was attributed in the PSI to the foster parent having said mm-hmm. that she said that.
But everybody said that she was a very good, she was doing very well in the PSI.
The motion hearing, as I recall, the state said she was eager to testify, but I don't get that.
At the plea hearing, she said that. Or the plea hearing, the prosecutor said that.
Yeah,
said
at the plea hearing, that's right. Not the motion hearing. Plea hearing.
And he said that she was in a good place, that she was strong, she was resilient, and she was eager to testify.
I don't want to raise an extraneous issue, but I'm going to do it. What are all the rights of confrontation here?
I'm sorry, Judge.
What are the defendant's rights of confrontation? You've got a child witness.
Well, in
won't
general,
testify. Go ahead.
Well, my understanding is that typically, it is, in most situations, the witness has to be there to testify. Now, clearly, she has to be available for cross-examination.
From driving.
And, if these tapes had been admitted under 908, she would have still had to be there for cross-examination. Now, in this case, my argument is they weren't even admitted under 90808 to begin with. The state can't be prejudiced by something they didn't have to begin with. The judge, if Judge Schwartz was premature in admitting these videotapes under as a prior consistent statement, that doesn't morph his ruling into a ruling that the interest of justice warranted entering these tapes as her direct testimony. He made no such finding. In fact, his finding was inconsistent with that. So, these tapes, to begin with, were not admitted under 90808.
Well, now we've got 5 years going since the incident.
Pardon?
It's now 5 years have passed since these incidents, roughly. So, 4.5. And we have a young woman now, an adult, right? She's almost 20. And
well, it's closer to 5 and a half than 4 and a half. Okay. It's a minor.
Then we have a court decision coming out, and assuming you win, this court decision, the earliest it might come out would be tomorrow. Not likely. More likely winter or spring or even summer. And then if you should prevail, we're moving into closer to 6 years, right, or 7. And then by the time it goes back after a motion for reconsideration and the record is remanded, I mean, we may, and by the time this is in Dane County, and I don't know what the delay period now is, but maybe 7 years before we retry this. And now, do you agree with the state that we consider it as of the date of the denial of the plea withdrawal, May 2010, which is what the state said?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Why do you believe that? What is there in the law that says that, and that we don't consider that this is going to now be 9 years or 8 years? I've forgotten what number I gave you.
Well, I guess I could make the argument that the state, if the state had not tried to raise prejudice, which I don't believe they could show at that time, she would have had her trial within a few months.
Well, I suppose the reason you have to look at it as of May in, what was it, 2010, is because that's when the trial court exercised its discretion. That's the facts in the record, and you can't look further on as to the consequences thereafter.
I'm sorry. I have a hard time hearing.
I'm assuming that the reason you have to look at the facts as of May 2010 when the trial court ruled is because the trial court's ruling is upheld on the basis of the facts then and the record then. It's not a rolling matter,
mm-hmm.
in fact, situation. So the fact that there won't be a trial for 9 years is not a relevant, under the law, relevant consideration.
I'm terribly...
Okay, forget it. I've stated what bothered me and what bothered Dave Prosser and resolved it.
Well, I didn't quite hear your question, but I guess there's something else I'd like to point out. And maybe this will relieve your concerns. Even if AO didn't testify, the state has enough evidence against Minerva Lopez. She made three statements to the right after she made her first statement in September of 2008. In that statement, she was shown pictures of AO. She pointed out the injuries she caused, and she pointed out how she caused them.
Do you think the state can rely solely on a defendant's confession?
Well, you have three confessions.
Okay. Do you think the state can rely in a trial solely on the confession of a defendant?
I think they can rely on her confession. They can rely on the doctor who examined AO right after AO was taken from her parents' home. And she can point out all the injuries that AO had.
Okay, so you're not saying the state would
it wouldn't be strictly on Minerva Lopez's testimony. But Minerva, the whole complaint in this case, all the allegations against Minerva Lopez were based on Minerva Lopez's statement, not on AO's statement. Now, there were some added things in the information. But the complaint with some 16 charges.
So you don't think it's of any interest or importance that a victim may or may not testify in a trial? Where a victim testifies is persuasive than a trial where a victim does not?
I believe in a situation the state could prove the case without her. I'm sure her testimony is important. But I believe the state could prove the case even if they didn't have her present. But in this case, we don't have any reason to believe she wouldn't be present. We don't have any reason to believe that she's forgotten anything. There's nothing in the record to support that. Now, the fact that there's a long time has passed isn't Minerva Lopez's fault. Wait.
It is absolutely the defendant's fault that she waited so long to move to withdraw her plea.
Can I speak to that, Your Honor? First of all, Minerva Lopez, she pled on the 18th of November. The court, Mr. Masoliak, her attorney, and Minerva Lopez's testimony all show that that was a very hasty decision to plead. She pled at that time because she was told she was never going to see her kids again, and she was told the only way she'd see her kids again, maybe, is if she testified at Olivas' trial. She had one day to decide. She pled. Now, she testified at Olivas' trial. She never heard anything else about whether she was ever going to be able to see her kids or how much time was going to she was going to get. And so she talked to her attorney, and she said, I feel like I've been tricked. And her attorney advised her, well, you can draw the sentencing was set for April 6th. She wrote to the judge on the 17th. The judge got the request on the 19th.
What month?
To withdraw her plea.
What month?
Pardon?
What month?
March.
Okay.
March 17th. Her attorney basically had told her, you know, if you're going to do this, you got to argue that I'm ineffective. So she wasn't just, you know, it wasn't, she testified at Oliva's trial. She was feeling hopeless about seeing her kids, and so she moved to withdraw her plea. I think she's willing to do anything to see her kids again. And she thought maybe that would do it.
So she waited 4 months to withdraw, to say she wanted to withdraw the plea.
And I want to make another thing clear. According to Mark Masoliak, she didn't know what this pre-sentence report had advised, because he hadn't provided it to her. And he said either she, you know, the only way she'd know that is if somebody else had provided it to her.
Was there any evidence that anyone provided it? Was there any evidence that anyone provided?
No, Your Honor.
Yes, okay.
So the state has the burden to prove substantial prejudice.
Right.
Prejudice in what way? Prejudice with regard to, prejudice in the manner in which the state can put on its case, or prejudice to the ultimate decision, in other words, guilty or innocent, and prejudice to what or in what way? When I look at this record, you were starting to say about her admissions. In fact, when I look at the sentencing hearing, and the state at the sentencing hearing says, Ms. Lopez, you are the one that formed the basis of the complaint, all of the admissions, and went through scene by scene of what she admitted to, which is the basis of the complaint. And he said, and then you have highly inculpatory statements, because right after you pled, I think he said, the very day of your admission, in recognition of the charges that you were convicted of, that you went and met with Detective Hale within an hour or so after she pled, with her attorney. Miranda rights were given, and she again made statements that the state said were highly inculpatory. And then the state at the sentencing hearing made reference and read the transcript from the trial of the father, questions and answers where she admitted she caused the abuse, she admitted specifics of the abuse, she admitted cutting her daughter, she admitted all in the question and answer form. So when I read this, I think that it is an exceedingly strong case for the state. And then when you put in with that in the sealed document where you have the
the discs of the interviews from October, the two interviews in October, you also have a disc that contains a multitude of pictures of every inch of her scars and injuries. I can't think of a much stronger case that the state could have. So I ask, substantial prejudice to what? The manner in which they put in their case or the possibility of getting a conviction? What's the law say?
I think State versus Nelson talks about that. And basically, in that case, there the victim was missing. And Nelson tried to withdraw his plea, and the state admitted that they probably could find the victim again. Mm-hmm. But the judge said, I'm going to find substantial prejudice because the victim is missing. Now, clearly, this was a case of rape and a burglary and a kidnapping, and clearly the victim could testify in more detail and more graphically about the fact that she had been sexually assaulted. But the Court of Appeals said the judge didn't even look at the strength of the state's case. They had Nelson's confessions, they had DNA from Nelson, and they had another witness who would say that one of the masked guys that committed these crimes was named Jamal, which was Nelson's name. And the court said that was enough to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. I think the question is, can they prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt? Not whether, you know, they have this testimony or that videotape. I mean, we tell juries to not make their decisions based on passion or prejudice. The fact that these videotapes were very graphic, and I'm sure they would be heart-wrenching to a jury, but the jury would still have plenty of evidence to convict. They would have Hale's testimony saying, Lopez said she hit her here with a bat. She did this. She did that. This wound was caused this way. This wound was caused that way. Lopez was totally open. She gave three very inculpatory statements.
What would you anticipate the defendant's defense would be at a new trial? Does she flat out say, count four, didn't happen? Count 11, didn't happen? Which of the 22 does she deny happening?
Well, at this point, I think part of her defense she would want to bring up would be mental disease or defect. Mental disease or defect. She did raise that originally and then dropped that plea, but I think that's something that she would want to raise. She does deny at four of the things that she pled to. She said that basically, you know, she admitted to all these charges, but four charges that she pled to, she says that she didn't do, that was Olivas that did that. So she would have a hard case. I can't deny it, but I think she in her own mind believes that she could at least, you know, point out the fact that she was extremely depressed. She was a abused wife. I think she wants to raise those things, you know, that she did certain things under coercion.
Oh, well, why did the trial court find that it was fair and reasonable to withdraw the plea? What was the basis for the fair and reasonable grounds for withdrawal plea?
Judge McNamara noted that on November 18th, there was a hearing, not a hearing, but a status conference. At that status conference, there wasn't a suggestion that this was not going to go to trial. Then the next day she pled. She testified that her attorney came and basically told her, hey, you gotta plead.
That's the basis.
Pardon?
The basis is this desire to see the children.
that too, and the fact that nobody was ever going to believe her, and so she better plead. She said, I didn't do some of this stuff. And she had, they said, you know, if you don't plead, the expert that they had hired told her she was never going to see her kids again. Well, that put her in a tizzy. Then her attorney said, well, maybe if you testify at Olivas' trial, there might be a possibility. He wasn't making her any promises.
Doesn't the record indicate that she went back and forth as to her acceptance of responsibility for certain counts? The judge made reference to letters that he had received from your client. At first, disavowing responsibility, but then I think at one point he makes reference, I may be wrong, please correct me if I am, to several different versions of her account of what she did and didn't do.
Well, I can't recall exactly what she had written in the letter. She wrote a number of letters, but she did, at the hearing when she testified, she said she didn't do four of the things. She pled guilty to six counts. She said she did two of them, and she denied doing four of them. Mr. Masiolek said that when he talked to her, she admitted to the two, and then she denied the four, and then sometimes she couldn't remember if she did it or not.
You don't have to go through all, but I wonder if there's any room in the law, and I'll ask your opposing counsel on rebuttal to address this, if he has any information. We're all talking about, gee, could the state prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt? And I hear several opinions that seem to be unanimous that the state could. Is there any room in the law for consideration of the right of this young lady to have her version of events told in the most accurate, most precise manner in which she recalled them? We are talking about 5 years ago. And is there any provision that you can think of that would allow the court or require the court to take into account her right to have her story told in the most accurate fashion possible, which of course would be memories don't usually improve with time. We all know this. Mm-hmm. And usually when they do, it's indicia that there's something amiss. And I just wonder, I don't know the answer to that question, but I suspect we'll be looking at it soon enough.
I guess I could just point out to the Snyder case that counsel referred to, where if the person was not able to recall, in this particular case it was a child who was not able to recall, they allowed the tapes in as part of the residual hearsay exception. But you know, this court has also held in terms of a child, I think it's State versus Gilbert, that we need the testimony of every person. And in that case, it was a 10-year-old child testifying against abuse by her parent.
Counselor, you know, 5 years have passed. The tape, as I've gone back and looked at the transcript again, showed the injuries. So it wasn't just a matter of her testifying to what was done. She had physical evidences of the injuries that are on the tape that wouldn't be present 5 years later when she testified. Can you address why that isn't substantial prejudice to be denied the use of that particular evidence?
Well, first of all, I think the state, as I said, can prove its case without that. But as the Court of Appeals pointed out, those tapes would be available for at least a video use. So you could see the injuries that AO had at the time. Plus, there were a number of pictures, still pictures. But, you know, if you needed the action photo, you had it. Obviously, they wouldn't show 3.5 hours of it, but you can get a good feel for how she is just at the beginning when she comes into the room. So If there's no further question, no. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. O'Neill? Mr. O'Neill, do you agree that under the Nelson case that there was no substantial prejudice because the court said there was enough evidence to convict beyond a reasonable doubt? Is that the test for substantial evidence, a substantial prejudice, or is the state proposing another test?
We're not proposing that the test is that the prejudice must be such that the state can no longer prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt.
Say that to me again.
We're not proposing that the test be that the prejudice must be so severe that the state cannot, or so substantial, I should say, cannot prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt.
What is the test? What is the test that you are proposing?
We are proposing a test that is within the exercise of the court's discretion to take into consideration the various facts of the case and conclude. Yes, the Nelson case made clear, and I agree that this should be part of the assessment, is to assess the strength of the state's case, but it doesn't have to be such that the state is unable to prove its case. It can be, as the Bowling Court pointed out and as the Rushing Court pointed out, a loss of detailed evidence that was important to the state's case. And I would say in this case, the loss of these recordings are really the best evidence that the state had against the defendant in this case.
Help me with this, because you could tell by my questions, I am not convinced that the recordings are really lost because of other statutory procedures. So in some ways, just like the Court of Appeals said that Judge Schwartz's decision comments that it could come in under prior consistent statements was premature because there were some foundational things, fabrication, motive that had to be shown. Isn't it also premature to say that this video won't be shown? I'm not convinced that it won't be shown.
I think it is premature to say that, because whatever reason the state could possibly get these recordings in at a future trial is at this point speculative. There's no basis for knowing that the recordings will be admitted, for example, as prior consistent statements. The state could seek to admit the recordings as pursuant to the residual hearsay exception, but that would depend on whether the trial court, in the exercise of its discretion, found that it met the requirements of that statute. What the state had in this case going forward after the court ruled that these recordings were admissible pursuant to 90808 was a guaranteed ruling that they could use them in their case in chief in lieu of the victim's direct testimony. And that is what's prejudicial to the state.
Because I can go to the transcript that says in conjunction with, we're going to have her testify. The court says you're certainly going to have her testify. Yes, we're going to have her testify.
What the state said, but I would point out that the statute does not require that. And the statute does allow for the recordings to be played without even the victim in the courtroom, and then the victim has to be produced for cross-examination. The state indicated that it would have the victim in the courtroom, but I don't think if the state wanted to change its mind about that, I don't know that it could be held to that.
The state can do anything it wants to, so to speak, but the record that we have before us in several places shows the state intended to have the victim testify in conjunction with, not in lieu of.
I think that's correct, and I can't speak to the extent that she was going to testify, although considering that these tapes are 3.5 hours long, I would have to imagine that they were going to be the bulk of her direct testimony.
I'd like to go back to a question you were asked a few minutes ago in regard to what is the test for substantial prejudice. And my attention, your response prompted my memory as to something that Judge Lunston said in his dissent in the Court of Appeals opinion, where he said on page 10, I acknowledge that the burden on the state is to prove, quote, substantial prejudice, end quote, and that courts have been directed to liberally permit plea withdrawal prior to sentencing. However, I find no requirement that the state prove that the prejudice be such that the state is substantially less likely to obtain a conviction. Rather, case law makes clear that trauma to a child and the loss of evidence can be sufficient. Is that your argument?
That is our argument, that our argument is ultimately that the determination of prejudice is discretionary for the trial court. And here the court found facts that were supported by the record, and it was made a decision consistent with the controlling case law that loss of evidence and harm to the victim and faded memories can be prejudice under the circumstances. And the court's decision, we believe, was reasonable.
Mr. O'Neill, I do want to call your attention. I heard you say, which may not be what you said or what you meant to say, that the state was assured that they could get in the audiovisual recording. But as I read 90808, it's discretionary with the judge.
That's correct, but the judge had already made a ruling that they would be admissible pursuant to 90808. I suppose there's a possibility that the defendant could have requested reconsideration.
Right, of course. Yes. But I just wanted to clarify that this is discretionary determination, not required.
No,
that
absolutely.
Be admitted.
Okay. Well, I was referring to the trial court's decision to admit them.
Okay. And Which could have been changed at trial.
It could have. But at that point, the state had a guarantee.
I understand that.
Right. Is there any other questions?
Hearing none,
thank
Mr.
you.
O'Neill, thank you. I want to thank both of you for an interesting discussion on prejudice and withdrawal of a plea prior to sentencing. That concludes our hearing in 11AP 2733, State versus Minerva Lopez. The court is in a recess until tomorrow morning, when it will hear three more cases on oral argument, and the court will meet in closed conference at 3:10. We are in recess.